Welcome to another PI World podcast. This is an audio-only version offered as another way to enjoy our great content. A full video version can be seen on piworld.co.uk, where you can find many more videos of interest to investors.
I'm here today with Edmund Ching, Global Chief Financial Officer at BNP Paribas Wealth Management and author of The Idle Investor. Edmund, thanks so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure, Tamsin.
Can you tell us a bit about your background?
Okay, well, I worked in finance for over 25 years, so I do have a, in quotes, professional background. But I actually kicked off my education with psychology. Then I went more into computing and artificial intelligence, and I ended up doing a PhD in that before realizing that the academic career was never going to suit me because it's, no. I wasn't good enough, and B, it seemed a bit boring. And so I thought, what am I going to do? And I thought, well, I like quite like doing some sort of research. So I went down the research route, but then I thought, well, academic research isn't it. So maybe something applied. And I sort of ended up looking at management consultants or investment banks. And management consultants, when I met those guys, like the McKinseys and the Bains, they were just dreadful people. So I thought, I can't possibly work in an industry with such dreadful people. But the investment banking sounded okay because it was interesting and seemed to pay quite well. So I fell into that. But I fell into that, interestingly, without any formal education in finance or economics. So, and been there ever since.
And you started there in research?
Yes, I started in the US investment bank Goldman Sachs in London back in the mid-90s in equity research. But I actually started in strategy. So rather than looking at single companies, I was looking more at the, sort of the overall markets because that's where they needed someone at the time. So yeah, I popped in and I was lucky to join up with a new head of strategy who's a lovely chap called Paul, who's actually one of my best friends now. We've stayed in touch for years and years and years. That was really the start of it.
And then more recently, you were on the sell side, weren't you?
So that's right. So I've been sort of here and there and everywhere. But my last role before, I was at BNP Paribas. I've been at BNP Paribas actually twice. And this second time I've been here since 2015. So I was doing equity derivative strategy within the investment bank. And last November, so November 2020, I switched over, staying within BNP Paribas, the French bank, but moving over to the wealth management side. So quite a shift of emphasis now. So yeah, I've moved from the sell side onto the buy side finally.
So how long was it before you started investing your own money?
Well, funny you should say that, Tamsin, because I started investing my money when I was 14. I seem to remember back in those dim, distant days, there were privatizations. So I dabbled in a couple of privatizations. I think British Gas was one. And then for some reason, I can't remember why, I decided that Marks and Spencer looked interesting. I think the dividend yield, I think I'd figured out what a dividend yield was, looked in the newspapers and it looked quite juicy back in, I can't remember, this must have been in the late 80s. And I thought it looked juicy. So I went down, toddled down to my local Midland bank, it was in those days, and bought some shares over the counter and got a share certificate. And that was my start. I mean, I didn't know what I was doing, obviously, but I'm not sure I still do now. But, you've got to start somewhere.
So you've been investing ever since?
Indeed, indeed.
So how did The Idle Investor, the book, come around?
Well, again, so this was what I wanted to do is provide people with a way to invest their money simply, because I think the problem is for people like yourself and me, Tamsin, we're passionate, we're interested, we love talking about stocks and looking at the stories, but not everyone is like that. A lot of people simply want an easy life. They want to invest their money, not leave it in the bank, but they don't want to be spending hours and hours, weeks and weeks studying what to buy. So the book came about as a simple way to say, look, without you having to devote a lot of brain power to this, here's a number of simple systems you can employ, and the amount of time you require will choose which system you want to use ultimately. But they're all quite easy to use. They're all mechanical, so there's not a lot of thought process involved, and there's no guesswork or trying to choose companies. You just buy these exchange-traded funds, follow the system, and generally the results should be pretty decent. It was as simple as that, really.
And what sort of performance would you expect someone to get if they followed that strategy outlined?
Well, again, depending which, there are three strategies in the book, but I would say anywhere historically between 10 to 14% historically. Now, of course, you have to caveat that, Tamsin, because equity markets in general have been pretty decent, but more important, bond markets have been very good. And some of those strategies do invest in bond ETFs, so would have benefited from that following wind, which maybe we don't have anymore today. So maybe going forwards, you probably would expect a bit less.
And personally, what sort of return are you hoping to achieve with your own portfolio?
I don't actually target a return because I think that's a bit of a fool's errand in a sense that we all know that some years you're going to have amazing years because the markets will be rampant and maybe right now is one of those periods. And there are other periods where you'll be in a bear market like in 2008 where it's pretty difficult to make any sort of money and you're lucky just to keep your head above water and not lose too much, not lose your entire shirt. So I recognize that the markets are very volatile and so I don't target an amount. What I would say is obviously I'm greedy just like everyone else. I have a long-term horizon, so that means I do take quite a bit of risk in my portfolios.
And when you're talking of sort of 10 to 15%, if you're upping the risk, what might that enable you to achieve?
Well, I mean, I would say the bottom, what I, in a good year when markets are not crashing and actually generally going up, I would say the minimum I would be expecting would be 20%. But I'd hope to get more than that, obviously.
Very nice. So in order to look towards achieving a 20% return, what sort of asset allocation are you looking at?
Well, as I said, it's aggressive. And right now, I would say the bond allocation is very low. In fact, I think bond markets are a bubble, particularly government bond markets. And I think the yields are ridiculous. I'm hardly at all invested there. I would say the sorts of assets I look at include real estate, commodities, but of course equities. I would say the biggest lump is equities, but right now I would say commodities are a surprisingly big amount and getting bigger by the day. And I also invest in commodities via the equities, as it were, so the mining stocks to be specific.
And how do you invest in property?
Well, I tend to do it listed because I've already got a house. So luckily, you know, my first objective was always to pay off the mortgage on the house because I don't like having debt. And so I think that's the best way to do it. The problem I find with property is I know people love buy to let, but personally, I don't, particularly because tenants can give you lots of problems. And on top of that, obviously, the UK government in particular has made it rather less attractive from a tax point of view to be a buy-to-let investor. So these days, I tend to do it via listed REITs, for instance, because I find those funds, you have liquidity. The problem with non-quoted properties, you don't have liquidity and you may get trapped in a bear market. And so I'd rather avoid that problem.
And in terms of commodities, you said you choose companies that have a commodity exposure, but do you invest in commodities per se, say gold or silver or copper?
Absolutely. Yes. I don't have any problem with that at all. I think they're a useful diversifier because when you invest in equities or you have a lot in equities, I think for your peace of mind, it's also good to have a second diversifying asset. So real estate for me would be one, but commodities would be another, which hopefully over the long haul would not be too highly correlated with equities.
And what sort of commodity exposure have you got at the moment?
Well, my approach, Tamsin, is very much a macro approach. So I try to pick big themes, big long-term trends. And I think one of the long-term trends I truly believe in is this new commodity super cycle, which I think has started. So, I mean, the background is from 2008 to 2020, commodities have been on a terrible run. You know, you really, yeah, whether it's gold, silver, oil, whatever, it was awful. However, for the last year or so, they've really started to do very well and across the board. So I focus at the moment on industrial and precious metals because I think those are the highest potential right now. I think supply is very limited. I think demand is recovering and will continue to recover and will be driven not only by economic recovery generally, which is, of course, good for commodities, but more importantly, we see supply shortages. And on top of that, we now also see an extra structural element of demand coming from the renewed demand for electric vehicles, renewable energy, which actually put a lot of pressure on the supply for a number of metals.
And you do that through ETFs, or do you do it through funds, or how do you get your exposure?
So if you're buying the commodity itself, you have a choice either of buying futures or ETFs. I tend to use ETFs, but I do some futures as well. The problem is, Tamsin, there aren't always very liquid ETFs, because I like to buy commodities like tin, for instance. So I actually have, there is an ETF on tin, so I found it and I've invested in it. I would say I do that, but the bulk of the investment in the commodity space is done by the miners, because what I want is operational leverage. What I mean is, when the prices go up, these guys make a ton more cash. That's what I'm looking for, to get that real, you know, leverage on the upside.
So moving to equities, which might include some of those commodity companies, what are your selection criteria? What are you looking for when you're selecting the equities for your portfolio?
Well, what I try to do is I try to work from the top down, work from the bottom up at the same time and meet in the middle. So the way I work on the macro side is, again, identify the big themes, the big trends, two or three or four, not too many, because my brain's not big enough to hold it all in, you know, so I try to keep it simple. Then I work my way down from those three or four themes and think, okay, what is the best way to invest in those themes? So if it's commodities, a commodity super cycle, which commodities, what are the drivers, and then then look at what are the instruments that you might use. So in this case, you might directly invest in the commodity, you might invest in an ETF, or you might say, no, actually, there are a whole host of very interesting companies that fit this theme very well. Now, what criteria would I use for those companies? Well, obviously, I look at sales and earnings growth. I look at profitability in terms of profit margin, and also in terms of return on equity. I do look at gearing, because I don't like highly leveraged companies, because I find they're very risky. And, you know, you can either make a fortune or you can lose a fortune. So over bitter experience of losing a fortune, sometimes I've decided gearing is not such a great thing. So I look for cash generative companies that generally have low levels of debt or even are net cash, particularly in the mining space, because I think there are so many stories of hope that end ultimately end in despair because they just don't deliver. So I like companies that deliver in terms of generating strong free cash flow, dividends, as well as being able to pay for their own investment without asking for more capital the whole time.
So have you got some specific examples of stocks that are, you know, your top holdings that fulfill those criteria?
Generally I have companies I've held for a long time, which are very much small caps, but have a very interesting either growth story or recovery story. MPAC is one that I know a lot of your viewers know about, and I love that company, and I think it's been a fantastic recovery story, and I've held that for a long time. I can't even remember when I bought it first, but it was a long time ago, and it's done extremely well and continues to perform very, very well. I think within the mining space, you could look at names such as Caledonia Mining, which I know from the recent stock slam, Damien Cannon certainly highlighted, and I've held that for many, many years. So I was completely in agreement with Damien on that one. And Sylvania Platinum, of course, was another one that's been coming up in a number of forums, such as the Mellow events. And that's one I've had for a long time, because I've been very, very switched on to the story for platinum group metals, but particularly palladium and even more so rhodium. And of course, Sylvania is primarily these days geared to the rhodium, to their rhodium output and share and commodity price. So those are some of the names that fit the criteria that I've held for quite a while.
And what percentage are you holding in ETFs, and what percentage are you holding in equities, roughly speaking?
That's a good question. I would say the majority is in stocks right now, as opposed to ETFs. So I do have a lot of single stock exposure.
And in terms of ETFs, what are the, say, couple that you are holding or the top ones you are holding?
So the sort of things I like are, for instance, a semiconductor ETF, because, again, you don't get a lot of semiconductors in the UK. I do hold some single stocks in the US, but actually one of the easiest ways to hold that is via a semiconductor ETF. And very nicely, there is a UCITS version, which is now available in the UK for the first time. So that's a good thing. Previously, you could only buy it in the US. Another one is video games and esports. So again, quite a specific theme, but this is an area which we know is seeing structural growth, obviously has benefited from the sort of whole coronavirus pandemic and work from home trend. But I think all that has done is accelerate an already existing structural growth trend. You know, it's, gaming is no longer the just for 18-year-old spotty teenagers. Actually, the core demographic is the whole family, but including very much the dads and the mums and the dads in their 30s and 40s these days.
And I know you think that cybersecurity is something that's going to be a growth market. How would you get exposure to that?
Yeah, cybersecurity is an excellent market, and you have a number of choices. You do have the ETFs, such as Legal in general, have a very good UCITS one, iSpy. Personally, I go for the single stocks because I think there is some value in the small caps in the UK when it comes to cybersecurity. And there's some very interesting companies, for instance, Intersea Group, which I know Paul Scott has been very much on. I've had that one for quite a while. Very much like that sort of digital identity story there. I've also been in CAPE, which used to be called CrossRider. That's another one, particularly on the virtual private networks, VPNs, which I think become more and more important if you want to protect your identity and stay anonymous, particularly when you're doing things like financial transactions online. You don't want to have your ID or any data stolen. I think that becomes bigger and bigger. So these are the sorts of names that I've been looking at. I'm sure there are a couple of others in my portfolio that don't come to mind right now, but those are some of the names that I definitely hold at, right at this very minute.
So with CAPE, there was questions about their accounting and bringing forward their revenues. Were you concerned about that?
I am. I'm also concerned by the fact that there's a very big shareholder who's an Israeli, and the Israeli links always make me a little bit concerned. So I actually have been lightening up on CAPE, to be honest with you, and going more into other names such as Interseed on that basis, because CAPE used to be a very big position for me, but it was when it was much, much cheaper. The valuation has really expanded as they've made lots of acquisitions and as the growth rate has stayed high and it's got become a much bigger company. But at this point, I'm less comfortable, as you said, Tamsin, with the story. There are some, shall we say, some not necessarily red flags, but orange flags. And that, I'm never going to put a huge amount of money into a company where there are a number of orange flags.
And I know you're also keen on renewable energy infrastructure. Mm. Where do you get exposure to that?
That's a tough one at the moment because it's just done so well. I've actually been reducing I love that story, but I have been reducing my holdings in that temporarily simply because the valuations are so high and the performance has been so strong. But there are very interesting stories that I do like, such as the Grid Investment Trust, which is about battery storage. Now, that's the Gresham House Investment Trust that looks at battery storage. What I like about that, Tamsin, is it's all very well talking about solar power and wind power, and I love that story, but ultimately, we also have to recognize that there are times when the sun doesn't shine, the wind doesn't blow, and what do we do for electricity then? And the answer is, well, we need more storage. And I think that's where this Gresham House fund comes in, because there's clearly going to be huge expansion in the need for battery storage on an industrial scale for households and industry. And so I think that is going to be very much a structural growth area. And by the way, there are very good yields on offer at the moment. So I think that's a very good way, particularly for an income-seeking investor, to A, invest in the renewable space, but also B, generate some very solid income streams as well.
Yeah. And moving on to the retail environment, then we've had GameStop, which has been interesting, and maybe a fallout from that, maybe, is IG and their margin requirement and all of that. What's your view on the retail market at the moment?
Well, it is a little bit frothy, in the States at least. In the UK, I think you might identify some elements of froth, but luckily, regulation, particularly for the retail investor, is much stricter. So I think that's one thing we can say. I mean, I'm not saying the FCA are magnificent or any financial regulator are particularly magnificent, but certainly the regulations I feel are tighter in Europe and in the UK than in the US. So I think you're not going to see the sort of Robin Hoods the selling of order flow to companies like Citadel. You're less likely to see that in the UK because regulation is tighter and retail investors have higher levels of protection. I mean, it's actually quite difficult as far as I understand, for a UK retail investor to buy single stock options, which is, of course, that's the way that the Reddit Wall Street Bets crowd were effectively taking exposure to GameStop.
And do you have any view on IG and how that might upset the market?
Do you know what, Tamsin? I don't think it's a bad thing, because it does force investors to deleverage, but it forces them to maybe focus on fundamentals as opposed to trying to get rich quick. I think what we need to remember, and this is something on IG's on their welcome page, the vast majority of retail investors on spread betting websites like IG lose money over the long term. They lose money. So in a sense, I'm not against forcing retail investors to deleverage their accounts, because maybe they'll lose less money. Maybe they'll focus on long-term capital appreciation as opposed to getting rich quick. Because I think getting rich quick is just, if you want to do that, that's fine, Tamsin, but go to the casino. Let's be honest, just go to the casino, take some play money, go to the casino, fine. But if you're talking about investment, that's not the way to go.
And what's your view for the rest of the year on the equity market? Do you think we're going to see great gains from here, or do you think that we're getting a bit toppy?
I'm pretty optimistic, I have to say, because I think the economic recovery globally that we see is still well in progress. Central banks are not going to change their tune. They're going to continue to support the economy, pump more liquidity into the economy. And then, of course, we have governments who are doing their bit by spending more and more money. So because borrowing is so cheap for them, they're borrowing more and more money and then spending it. The European Union have got a recovery fund, which will start spending money very, very soon, particularly in areas like renewable energy. The US under Joe Biden is likely to do the same thing as well in the US. So again, more government spending there as well. And so when I look at, and Rishi Sunak in the UK is likely to continue to keep the taps on, because unemployment is still high. We have not recovered. I mean, if you look at it at the moment, retail is still suffering. Hotels, restaurants, bars are all shut, or you can only deliver takeaway. So they're very limited in the sort of activity they can undertake, which means the economy is still to some extent limping along. And until we get a full reopening of the global economy, which should occur in the next few months, but until that happens, I really don't see any of this changing. There's so much support for the economy. Unemployment needs to come down, which I think is still good news for risk assets like equities.
Edmund, I could talk to you all day, but we have run out of time. But do tell people where they can find you.
Well, I am on Twitter, so my handle is at The Idle Investor. And also, I do write on Stockopedia, so if you're a Stockopedia subscriber, you'll see my articles on there as well.
Many thanks, Edmund. And to all our listeners, to find more interviews like this, go to piworld.co.uk. Stay well.
PI World videos and podcasts are for general information and interest. They do not constitute any kind of recommendation or inducement to buy shares of any company. PI World is not offering any kind of financial advice, and nothing in our material should be taken as such.